been making our way through the various categories of dormant commerce clause analysis. And I thought it might be useful to post something of a summary of our categories. We have, of course, looked at state and local laws that discriminate against out-of-state commerce, including facial discrimination and laws that have a discriminatory effect, two different kinds of laws that discriminate. And we, of course, have also looked at laws that are motivated by economic protectionism, which the court considers to be an illegitimate purpose under the Dormant Commerce Clause. And what remains is cases that don't fall into any of the first two categories, but are statutes that neither discriminate nor are motivated by economic protectionism, whatever is left once we've gotten through the first two categories. So if a law falls into either 1A or 1B or 2, what analysis would you use to consider whether the law is constitutional or not? The strict test, that's right, because we've seen the court do this on a couple of occasions in each of the categories, talking about laws that have a discriminatory purpose or motivated by economic protectionism, as well as laws that discriminate on their face or have a discriminatory effect. And in each and every one of these circumstances, the court has used the strict test. That's pretty much all of the Dormant Commerce Clause cases we've looked at to date. And we were talking about the Hunt case and the North Carolina regulation of apples, which falls within this general group within these categories. And which of these categories specifically does Hunt fall within? 1A, 1B, or 2? What kind of case is Hunt?
One B.
Laws that have a discriminatory effect on out-of-state commerce. Why doesn't Hunt fall into category 2? What purpose does the state assert for the law that it enacts? Is it help? This apple grading system makes people healthy, or I know the old phrase, an apple a day keeps the doctor away, but
it's not health, but like a food quality standard.
Food quality standard, okay. And who's being protected by this food quality standard? Consumers, says the state. Well, is there something on its face a little odd about the notion that this is a consumer protection statute? Where do these labels appear?
Well, they appear on the cartons, but the...
On cartons? When you say cartons, like, you mean when you go to the store and buy a carton of apples?
On the carton or the apple?
It's on the
crate.
On the crate. Who sees the crate?
Buyers,
the fruit buyers for the supermarket chains, etc. So consumers don't actually see the label that the state is all worried about, right? It's seen only by people who presumably know something about fruit quality because they're fruit buyers. And so there is a little bit of skepticism about the notion that the state could really be seeking to protect consumers by this, I'll call it, uniform grading system. Let's get rid of those terrible Washington State grading system and simply use the USDA grades. What might be the other reason for this statute? Well, remember why it has a disproportionate effect, why it's discriminatory in effect?
It gives local apple growers an advantage.
By
because they're already doing it. There's no financial cost to them.
It gives them an advantage, and who does it take away an advantage from anyone else?
It takes away from Washington, because Washington actually has better apples, yet they're being, they look like they're the same quality as the inside.
Right, so everybody has to have the U.S. extra fancy grade, and there's no Washington extra fancy grading permitted. So since the law has the effect of benefiting North Carolina apple growers and taking away an advantage that Washington State apple growers would otherwise have in the North Carolina market, what might be its purpose?
Economic protectionism,
right? And of course, if the court were to recognize that this law is an example of economic protectionism, we go right to the strict test, and that they fail the test automatically because that purpose would not even be viewed as legitimate. But as it is, while the court has a lot of skepticism about the asserted purpose of consumer protection, as the state describes it, they nevertheless go on and analyze the law, assuming that that is the purpose. They find the discriminatory effect for the reasons we've said, and now what has to happen next? Once the court decides there's a discriminatory effect and a legitimate purpose of consumer protection, what's the next piece of the analysis? Do we balance under the strict test?
Oh, no, it's automatic.
So what do we do?
Well, one thing is we have to see if there's any less discriminatory alternatives.
Yes, we have to see whether there are other ways to protect consumers while at the same time not discriminating against out-of-state apple growers. And is there some way to make everyone happy? In other words, to protect North Carolina consumers. Remember, originally, Washington apples came into the state with the label Washington Extra Fancy Apples. And after this law went into effect, they had to change their label, so they now said U.S. extra fancy apples. What's the alternative that might be available?
They could have both.
They could have both, which is what the court says. So you leave the Washington extra fancy apple grade on the package, but you add the uniform USDA grade in addition. So they have two labels, so if you're interested in knowing whether it's some superior state grade, you know from this, whereas if you're interested in comparing Washington apples versus North Carolina apples to see how they come out on a common scale, you can look at the USDA grading system. And that's what the court says. To protect consumers, you don't have to obliterate completely the Washington grading system. You can leave it in place and just require an additional piece of information be added to the label, because by and large, when the court considers consumer protection measures that provide information, almost always more information is better than less information, and so this solution, this alternative, is a more information solution as compared to a less information solution. So the court says using this test, there are alternatives, and the state therefore loses under the strict test. What would happen if the court decided that there wasn't enough evidence of discriminatory effect.
They would use the balancing?
They would use the balancing test. What do you think would happen if they applied the balancing test? What do we balance when we use the balancing test? What are the variables that are on the scale?
The state's interests and the burden to interstate commerce.
Okay, so we look at the weight of the state's interest and we look at the burden on interstate commerce. Okay, and let's see. I have eventually, once it loads, come on, you can do it. Ah, okay. So here we have our balancing scale. So, let's start first with the burden on interstate commerce from this statute. What kind of burdens are we talking about?
Washington is losing its edge.
Okay, can we quantify that?
I think so. because we could do, so the cost of shipping it to North Carolina and the
is it going
to
cost any more than previously?
No, but they could probably show how much their sales have diminished.
Ah, okay. So a decline in sales, if we could quantify that pre-law, post-law, we might be able to come up with a dollar amount.
They're going to have to print two different crates of.
Okay, new labels, different label system, one label North Carolina only, and the other, presumably Apple's going anywhere else, they want to keep the Washington state label. So they're going to have extra labeling costs. So both of those are quantifiable in dollar terms. So let's imagine here, let's make this side the burden, so let's put $2, $4, okay, so that's the burden on interstate commerce. Okay, so what do we have now on the benefit side? State says we have consumer protection benefits. Are the consumer protection benefits quantifiable in dollar terms? I mean, what exactly are they? How would you describe the benefits?
I think they could show that their sales went up from their own state's apples.
Can they show that as a benefit? That sounds like economic protectionism. They told us this is consumer protection. I mean, if you eat better quality apples, will you be healthier?
Along those lines, if they had some kind of, outbreak.
Maybe they can argue that more people are buying apples because they trust them.
Oh.
And
so
apples are healthy food.
A certain amount of quantitative somehow
you think we're going to be able to show that this law produced an upsurge in the quantity of apples that people bought?
The wrong number of
people. Do you think it's likely people aren't even going to see these labels?
No, we can make the argument.
But can you make the argument if you don't have any proof? Is conjecture going to cut it in this kind of a case? Can the state come in and say, well, we think that it might increase apple sales?
Talking about sales, I'm still talking about health.
Can
we present the evidence that the health did go up?
How can we show causation? Can we show that it's because people are eating, if we can't prove they're eating more apples, and nobody's arguing that any of these grades are, diseased apples, right? This is only a question of how good is the apple in some world in which we're kind of imagining, graded based on shape, taste, uniformity of skin. I don't really know how you not sure how we would grade apples, but presumably they have some way, number of blemishes, presumably. But we have no reason to think that any of these grading characteristics are necessarily the difference between eating a healthy apple and an unhealthy apple. I mean, at least the state's not claiming that this is the problem.
I can't think of anything that they could really say that would show that there was a true consumer protection component to that, like one apple being more healthier, or how, I just don't think it's a good argument.
Okay, so maybe we can't show it at all, even if, I mean, we could try and show it, but we don't really seem to have much proof. We have conjecture, which is not going to be sufficient. And suppose we could show some health benefit, let's imagine. What's it worth? I mean, we have dollars on one side of the scale. What do we have on the other side of the scale? What's our, what is it we're measuring?
It's supposed to be, isn't consumer protection to like save, it's not necessarily to improve the health, but kind of protect them from something bad?
Well, consumer protection can be protecting people from something bad, but it can also be providing people with enough information to make an informed decision. And maybe this law is just an informed decision law, not necessarily. Consumer protection can also be about wise expenditure of your funds. So if you knew that one product was no better than the other, you wouldn't want to pay more for it if you thought that they were the same. And presumably, that's one of the things that this law makes it seem as though these two apples are the same, and therefore you wouldn't want to pay more for the North Carolina, for the Washington apples if you thought they were no better than the so it protects consumers against spending more money. I mean, is that's another form of consumer protection, and it may be what the state is arguing here. Well, even if we could figure out what we're measuring, are we going to be able to compare it to the financial costs of the labeling that the apple growers are going to have to do? Can we put it on the scale and balance the two sides?
Can we, I mean, so is this one of the problems with any of these balancing tests, is that we're always, in a sense, no pun intended, trying to balance
apples and oranges? At least apples and oranges are both fruits, and so in theory we could assess them on a common scale. But here, of course, we don't have even that commonality, and it's why in talking about this, Justice Scalia uses a phrase in which he says, it is more like judging whether a particular line is longer than a particular rock is heavy. Says these just have nothing in common, the length of the line versus the weight of the rock. Well, suppose we could figure out some way to put them on a common scale in this case. What do you think would happen? I mean, we've talked about whatever modest consumer benefits there might be. How much do you think they would weigh? A lot? A little?
Less.
Okay, so no more than, let's say, 2 units. And as it turns out, if it's only 2 units, then the burdens outweigh the benefits, because the benefits seem to be quite slight, and therefore, on a kind of a pure balancing scale, it seems as though the state would lose even using the balancing test, let alone using the strict test, where they obviously clearly lose. Okay, so let's take a look at some additional examples of the balancing test to see whether it's any more satisfactory when we use it in any of the other cases that we have. Interestingly, the case was, and the book points this out, it was constructed in Pike versus Bruce Church, which is famously called the Pike Balancing Test. But the law that was being challenged in that case, at least if you looked at it, if the modern court were to look at it, how would they classify it? This statute required that if you grew cantaloupes in Arizona, that you had to crate them up and put on the crate grown in Arizona before you could ship them out of state. What do you think? How would we classify that statute under our various categories? Because why are they doing it?
Right, because they're doing it so that they make sure that in-state is doing the processing and shipping.
There's not much processing here. This isn't a processing, it's a crating law. You've got to package them, but you don't have to do anything to them. This isn't like the timber. It's not really a processing statute in the ordinary sense. It's a kind of a packaging statute.
But it costs them more to send it out of state, so it's easier or cheaper for them to sell it in-state, and that's an economic advantage to the in-state sales.
Well, is that what Arizona's trying to accomplish here? Why do they want these cantaloupes to bear the stamp made in, grown in Arizona? What?
What alone the cantaloupe people?
However, they have really good cantaloupe.
That's so. Right. They were a grower. It turns out that Bruce Church, Inc. was a grower of high-quality cantaloupes. So the state didn't want those cantaloupes to be shipped to California and sold in California without people knowing that they were Arizona-grown cantaloupes in order to hope that that would help the Arizona cantaloupe industry generally, because they would associate Arizona cantaloupes with high-quality cantaloupes. Is that an impermissible purpose? It's a kind of an odd purpose because it's not really like the other cases we've seen. Is it discriminatory in effect? Is it economic protectionism? Is it protecting your own economy by wanting the world to know that the cantaloupes were grown in Arizona? It doesn't quite fit really anywhere in the ordinary sense. It's the opposite of Hunt, because instead of preventing people from saying they're high quality Washington apples, they're requiring that they say they're Arizona, Arizona, and we know they're high quality cantaloupe. So it's kind of the reverse. It does seem like some kind of a home processing requirement. It's not processing in the normal sense, but they are requiring that something happened in Arizona that the grower wants to happen in California. Packaging of the product has to happen in Arizona. Although that isn't even clear, because presumably they could take them to California, crate them up, and as long as they stuck that label on, grown in Arizona, that may well comply with the state statute. So this law was a kind of a neither fish nor fowl. It was hard to really say what it was, and the court decided that in that circumstance they weren't willing to say that it was discriminatory or protectionist. And that they were going to craft this balancing test and decide that this kind of test applies when we don't have any of the things we previously had. No discrimination, no protectionism. And so they used this test. And what happens under the test? Under the Pike balancing test when it comes to the Arizona cantaloupe statute.
They said that costing $200,000 to church was way too excessive for the state's purpose.
For the state's benefit, right? And the court says this is a tenuous interest. We may assume that the asserted state interest is a legitimate one, because we can't quite decide it's illegitimate. But the state's tenuous interest in having the company's cantaloupe identified as originating in Arizona cannot constitutionally justify the requirement that the company build and operate an unneeded packing plant in the state. So the court says that as they see these interests. Now, do they actually weigh them? I mean, we've just seen what the court says about how these interests compare, the state interest versus the cost. On which side of the equation is it easier to come up with numbers?
Churches.
I mean,
churches. And is that almost always going to be true, that the that the private interest, in this case, the Arizona cantaloupe grower, is, but in other cases, the trucking company or whoever it is always going to have an easier time quantifying the interest the burden that they assert? And why is that? What kind of burden are we always going to be looking at? That's right. Whatever they're talking about, it's always going to wind up being about money. I mean, or you might say time and money, but time is money. So in the end, you could, even time could get described in monetary terms. If it takes longer to deliver the product because you have to go a longer distance, that's also going to cost you money for various reasons. More hours for your drivers, more gas, a longer time to market, maybe reduces sales, increases the spoilage rates. In the end, everything that is a burden on interstate commerce is going to be quantifiable in monetary terms, or virtually everything. So that side of the scale is always going to be about a financial burden, one way or another.
So it seems like on the other side, because it is hard to quantify things like health and so forth, it seems like the only way that you could is by having something so very extreme.
Okay, well, let's see what happens. I mean, we have a couple of cases involving safety, which is one of the predominant interests that's often compared to the burden on interstate commerce, and we have a few of them. There have been a number of cases involving trucks traveling in interstate commerce.
Yeah. Is part of the what makes it way more on the state side, like the type of interest? Like if it's health and safety, it weighs more, but if it's just this kind of like mysterious motive for the cantaloupe law, then it doesn't have to be.
I think it's probably true that the court has some sort of value judgment it attaches to different kinds of interests. But even despite the fact that that is true, we have a bunch of cases where the safety interest loses. So just because you assert safety, that doesn't mean that you've won if you're the state. It's probably a better kind of claim than some sort of dubious consumer protection claim or some of these other cases where the exact value is hard to even describe. But it's no guarantee where you're going to win. And the question is, why is that? And so let's take as an example what happens in Castle versus Consolidated Freightways Corporation, where the state of Iowa precludes 65-foot doubles from being driven through the state of Iowa. So what's the burden that comes to Consolidated from this? What do they have to do?
They cannot, so they have these 65-foot doubles, and they're too large for Iowa. Iowa will only allow 55, so it means either A, they have to do extra shipments because they have to use these smaller, or they have to do some crazy pulling over, repacking,
Okay, separate the doubles and into singles,
right.
and use more cabs with single
right.
trailers traveling through. So more equipment costs, more time, what else can they do? If they don't want to change their fleet of trucks, what's the other option?
Go around.
Go around, okay. And going around is going to be a burden because? More time, it's going to take them longer. I mean, if Iowa was the most direct route, then suddenly they're going to have to take a longer route to get to where they're going, and so that's going to be more expensive. And they managed to show that Iowa's law added $12.6 million each year to the cost of trucking companies, and Consolidated alone incurred about $2 million per year in increased costs. Now, how come Consolidated gets to assert what it costs it each year, an additional cost, $2 million, plus what it costs other trucking companies each year?
Because the law affects all trucking companies?
Right, and the question is, what's the burden on interstate commerce, not what's the burden on Consolidated? So Consolidated is able to introduce evidence that's going to quantify the general burden on interstate commerce, and they do quite precisely, not 12.5 million, not 12.7 million, but 12.6 million. And presumably, they had experts testify as to the source of those numbers, and the court found them to be credible, and the state didn't manage to demonstrate that the expert testimony was unreliable in any way, and so that stands that there is this quantifiable burden on interstate commerce. So let's just imagine that here we have our burden on interstate commerce. One block for every $4 million. Now what happens? What happens on the other side? I mean, the state asserts safety, and safety means what? What are the characteristics of additional safety? What do we get when we get more safety?
Less accidents.
Less accidents, which means?
Less money spent on.
Less money spent, plus?
Quality of life.
Is safety just about money?
Lives, more
lives. Lives, okay. Fewer injuries, more lives saved. I mean, safety, right, it holds a lot of weight because we're talking about saving people's lives or at least preventing them from being injured. And so on the face of it, safety is a very heavy weight. Now, of course, but how would, suppose the answer in this case, which it is not, suppose the answer was that this would increase safety by 5% and save 10 lives a year. Little more than $1 million a life. I mean, can we do that? Can the court decide how much of a financial burden saving 10 lives is worth? Well, it could.
Wouldn't they want to show kind of just like the associated dangers with these long trucks and different types of things that happened in the past that they were trying to avoid, and I guess put some dollar amounts to it, but maybe just more about like, you know, one in every 100 passengers on the highway is injured by one of these.
Okay, so maybe we don't need dollars. Maybe we can show just the kinds of accidents that are avoided. We need, in that sense, scientific evidence, which is going to demonstrate what kinds of safety advantages these shorter trucks have over the longer trucks, even if we can't say exactly how many lives saved or accidents avoided, if we could at least show that it's safer, and then we can assume that safer means fewer accidents. Suppose we could show that. Is that going to weigh more than the financial burden on interstate commerce if we can show this kind of accidents avoided?
I think it would make a difference. They're saying that the evidence clearly established that the twin was as safe as the semi, but if you were if you could have proved otherwise, that would have made all the difference in the world.
Okay, so if the state could have shown some safety benefit overall, that would have been enough. But here the problem was what? I mean, the state had all kinds of arguments about the fact that these the shorter trucks were safer. Didn't they? I mean, they argued they caused fewer accidents.
Well, they tried to say that, and they later kind of admitted that the longer trucks were actually safer. Mm-hmm. So they kind of did themselves a disservice in addition to all the other evidence.
Okay. So they really didn't have any evidence of a safety benefit. And it seems as though for every safety advantage, there was a safety disadvantage. And it kind of equaled each other out. And then if the safety advantages equal the safety disadvantages, what's the other problem with shorter trucks versus longer trucks? More trucks equals more accidents. And in general, the more trucks you have on the road, the more accidents you have. The more miles traveled, truck miles traveled, the more accidents. So there was no safety advantage, and then it would produce more trucks on the road. So actually, what do we really have on the benefit side of the scale? Negative, that's right. We have a negative value. It makes it less safe. Well, whatever the balancing test wins, who's gonna, whatever it means, who's gonna win if we have financial burdens versus safety deficit? Right, how are you gonna go, right. So this case turns out, as the Supreme Court at least evaluates the evidence and as the lower courts evaluated the evidence, this turns out to be an easy case because the state cannot prove any safety advantage at all. They assert a safety advantage, but they can't prove a safety advantage. And in these cases, just like, remember, Maine versus Taylor, we had the battle of the experts, and it was all about proof. In these cases, too, the state has to prove what it asserts. It just can't speculate about the nature of the benefit.
I kind of like, it seemed like the opinion said something about how because there was an ulterior motive, they weren't going to give the state deference. It was kind of confusing what role that played. It seemed to be a factor.
Yeah, because they talked.
Yeah, this case has a little bit of a complication that some of the other cases don't have, because the law that Iowa enacted had some provisions in it that were discrimination in favor of local commerce as against interstate commerce. Now, none of those provisions of the law were being directly challenged by Consolidated because they didn't affect Consolidated's business. They weren't in the business of shipping mobile homes through the state or any of the places where these discriminatory pieces of the statute, of the statutory scheme existed. Presumably, if we had had, let's say, an out-of-state mobile home manufacturer who complained that they couldn't ship their oversized mobile home through Iowa, but they would have been allowed to if they had, if they were an Iowa mobile home manufacturer, then that law would be analyzed not under the balancing test, but under the strict test, because it discriminates on its face against out-of-state commerce based on where your manufacturing operation is. So there were some provisions of the statute which were clearly discriminatory. None of those were being challenged in this case. And the question is, well, can the plaintiffs, can Consolidated make any use of the fact that the law does contain discriminations, even though they are not challenging those aspects of the law? And with some of the justices, that argument was a winning argument. So Justices Brennan and Marshall said that this law is protectionist and therefore impermissible under the Commerce Clause. For them, this was a simple case. For Justice Rehnquist, that fact was irrelevant, and he thought the state, the court wasn't sufficiently deferential to the state. For the majority, it's not so clear exactly what use they are making of that, of that fact. And the way to kind of think about this is, suppose there were those sections of the law didn't exist. Suppose we get rid of, we revise the law, we get rid of all this discriminatory sections. Does anything change? Does the law suddenly become constitutional, whereas it was unconstitutional under this analysis? Would it change the outcome if we get rid of the discrimination? We still have the problem that the state couldn't prove any safety benefit. Isn't that going to be enough? Does this test, to some extent, you've raised the question of what kind of, does this test have any kind of preference for either the government or for the challenger? I mean, we've seen typically under the strict test, the strict test presumes that the government is going to lose, and deferential tests presume that the government's going to win. What about this balancing test? Does it have a presumption one way or the other in terms of who's likely to win and who's likely to lose in this kind of circumstance where we're burdening but not discriminating against interstate commerce? What do you think? There's some kind of default rule or presumption that operates here? You raised the question, what do you think?
I think that it's not a fully formed like test, but it's sort of like indicating that if it really appears to be a legitimate health and safety reason, then they're going to defer to the state more. And they're not.
Is it enough that it's a reason, a health or safety reason, without any proof that it actually advances those interests?
I can see
no proof at all that it advances those interests.
I think according
let's
to
let's look at the language of the test. Let's look more carefully at what we know about the test before you want to commit yourself to saying it doesn't matter. All they have to do is assert health and safety. There is this test this balancing test that the court talks about has its origins in some earlier cases. And a good place to look at this test is on 223 on the top in an old case from 1945, Southern Pacific Company versus Arizona, where the court says, first full paragraph, the decisive question is whether in the circumstances the total effect of the law as a safety measure in reducing accidents and casualties is so slight or problematical as not to outweigh the national interest in keeping interstate commerce free from interferences which seriously impede it and subject it to local regulation which does not have a uniform effect on the interstate journey which it interrupts. So that language says to us, if the total effect of the law in reducing accidents is slight or problematical, slight or maybe non-existent, problematical, whether there's any benefit, the state is going to lose. So when does the state win?
When there's a substantial effect?
Does it even have to be substantial?
Any effect? Any more than slight?
More than slight or problematical. That's right. The law does have a kind of, the test does have a kind of presumption of constitutionality, but the presumption doesn't attach to just asserting we care about safety. Because it's pretty easy to just say it, but that is not going to be sufficient. The court requires at least some proof that there is some positive safety effect that's more than slight or problematical, whatever exactly that amount is. Now, in Castle, the amount of safety benefit was less than slight, and clearly was problematical. The court even says there's a safety deficit. Makes it less safe. So the law this test does include a kind of a presumption in favor of the constitutionality of the state law, but it still requires that the state be able to demonstrate that there is at least some kind of a beneficial effect, not just a beneficial purpose, but an actual beneficial effect that they can measure in some respect. They can get some expert to testify about the actual benefits of the law, not just, hey, trust us, we're the good guys, we're doing this for safety, because presumably they do that for every single example of economic protectionism. They'd say safety, and if that was a winning strategy, then they'd win all the time. And that's not going to be enough. Yeah?
In terms of what you were just saying about that, whether that would be enough, if it's more, so if the state shows that it's more than just a slight safety concern, is that it, or?
Not a concern. It's very important the court uses the word effect to talk about the fact that it's not just that they're concerned with safety, but there is some positive safety outcome here, some safety effect, plus safety is the result of this law. We have more, we are safer than without the law in some fashion.
But then do they still look at what the burden is on interstate commerce, or is that it?
Well, this seems to say that the degree of the burden in most circumstances is not necessarily going to be outcome determinative, right? I mean, this makes it seem as though it's not really a balancing test. I mean, it's called a balancing test, and the court sometimes talks about it as though it's a balancing test, but maybe it's not as much a balancing test as it first meets the eye, because if the state always wins, if the total effect of the law as a safety measure is more than slight or problematical, and that always outweighs the burden on the national interest, except maybe in some unusual cases. I mean, that's the kind of the caution. It's not exactly clear how much of a balancing test this is, because if you look at the cases, in every single case, the court finds the case to be incredibly easy to resolve, as it turns out. Like, we don't have a lot of facts about Bibb versus Navajo freight lines, but it's definitely sort of a great example of this. This is a case in which Illinois requires that trucks, as on 223, use contour mud guards on their trucks. Some kind of shaped mud guards have to be used. So here we have our contour mud guards. Okay, so this is Illinois. And here we have our straight mud guards, which are used in 45 states and are required in Arkansas. Says you have to have straight mud guards. So why does Illinois say they are requiring contour mud guards? Presumably not just to be different. What would be their explanation for why they're changing the standard from the traditional straight mudguard standard.
I would imagine safety.
Safety, that's right. They say contour mudguards are going to reduce accidents, just like with the smaller, the shorter trucks, the same exact argument. Navajo Freight Lines argues what's their argument going to be? You know immediately, right?
It's going to cost them money, and plus it's against even other states' laws, so what are they going to change mud guards between states?
Okay, right. So they're going to say it's going to be very burdensome, even more than the Iowa law. Although there are some facts that you probably need to know exactly how burdensome this is going to be. What would you like to know to really understand the degree of the burden here?
I'd like to know the cost of the guards and how...
The guards themselves are not that expensive.
Is it possible for them at the state line to have to change them out and then do it again on the side?
Well, here's the problem. This isn't like Velcro. We just don't, you know, tear them off one and slap on the other. It turns out that these mud guards are welded onto the trucks.
Wow.
It takes somewhere between 2 and 4 hours to change them, and you have to be using welding equipment, which is obviously problematic depending on what you're transporting in your truck. Not to mention that the drivers aren't necessarily qualified as welders to do this kind of work. So it turns out to be extraordinarily difficult, if not impossible, to switch mud guards, which means you can't use the same trucks in Illinois and in Arkansas because of the difficulties or the impossibility of making a switch in the kind of mud guard midway through the journey or at some point during the journey. So the burdens here are quite large in terms of the difficulties of coping with this, because in at least in Castle, was it possible for Consolidated to outfit its fleet of trucks so that it satisfied the standards in every single state with one kind of truck in Castle? Smaller trucks, that's right. If they kept their trucks, since Iowa had the most restrictive standard, typically if you follow the most restrictive standard, you're gonna be okay everywhere else. What about in this case? No way, right? Because as it turns out, Illinois and Arkansas have inconsistent standards, and there's no way to be in compliance to have both the straight and a contour mud guard at the same time, and we've identified the fact you can't switch them out. So you'd have to have a separate fleet of trucks depending on whether you were going to Illinois or going to Arkansas. And so this was a particularly burdensome, and it had a particular kind of burden that the court really hates, which is the burden of extraterritorial effect. In other words, that the state law burdened had an impact outside, beyond the borders of the state. So some laws are only affect the company while they're in the state, right? So for instance, some of those laws we saw where you had to toot your horn at a certain railroad crossing or something. Once you leave the state, you can stop tooting your horn. But this statute meant that Illinois' standard would affect the configuration of the truck beyond the borders of Illinois. So it had a so-called extraterritorial effect, which is, the minute the court says that, you're in trouble in terms of the burden of interstate commerce, never mind the financial burdens that this involves. So there was a substantial burden on interstate commerce, which would have made it a hard case if the state had evidence of safety benefits, because then we would have had Joe's problem case of what happens if there are, you know, significant burdens, but also safety benefits. But as it turns out, when the court reviewed the evidence here, the answer is that I must have left it upstairs. The case says that this kind of mudguard, the contour mudguard, causes certain kinds of accidents that the straight mudguard does not cause. So, for instance, the contour mudguards had a tendency to fall off on the highway. Not a good thing. And they had some other problems as well. And so when the court got through looking at the safety benefits versus the safety disadvantages, they concluded that the contour mudguards were actually less safe than the straight mudguards. So the case was exactly like Castle in the end, because even though we had a big burden, we had no safety benefits at all. We had negative safety because there were more, for every problem, for every safety advantage, there was two safety disadvantages that were produced by this new kind of mudguard. And I think another thing that was a problem was that this particular kind of mudguard built up heat on the brakes, which was not a good thing either. So there were a lot of safety disadvantages, and in the end, the court says, well, there's no safety advantage. It's not slight or problem. It's less than slight or problematical. So the state loses. Now, would they have lost, given the degree of burdens, if they could have shown some plus safety? Of course, we're never going to know the answer to that, because the court didn't have to grapple with that case.
That's actually what I was going to ask, but have there been cases where they have found, like, say if it turns out that the contoured ones were much safer, and Arkansas was just kind of outdated in their law, and so, yes, there's this extra territory.
Well, this case involves the problem of the safety innovator. Now, it turns out they were an innovator, but there was no, they were wrong. But imagine if they had been an innovator, the first one to recognize this improvement. But it really was an improvement. Are they going to win? I mean, that's really the question that you're asking. I think there's a substantial chance they could win in that circumstance. I mean, we don't know for sure. Maybe it depends on how much evidence of safety advantage they manage to mount. And maybe it would be helpful if we could show that some other states are about to come along and innovate in the same way. I mean, they just happen to be in advance of the others. But the court has never had to grapple with that case, because magically, every case they've had before them that falls into this balancing test realm, they've always managed to find that there was no safety or health advantage from whatever it was that the state was doing. And so we don't know for sure. I mean, all you can do is apply the balancing test, and if you're representing the government, you try and show every kind of safety advantage you can. And if you're you try and talk about the presumption of validity and hope that helps you out. And if you're representing the challenger, you try and show all of the burdens and that the safety benefits are dubious, not proven, whatever the argument is that you can make, or that your witnesses can help you to make. And you just kind of hope for the best, because there's really no exact precedent that demonstrates. Now, so you might argue that every time the court manages to avoid the hard cases by somehow magically always finding there's no safety advantage, in which case there's not much presumption of validity that's attaching to the law, that the court is working hard to find that the evidence doesn't promote safety. But in fact, I think the record in these cases, often voluminous, tends to support the court's conclusion and often the state, the court is sometimes deferring to lower court decisions which made findings, just like in Maine versus Taylor, that are the same as what the Supreme Court is now concluding. So the district court finds no safety benefit. The Supreme Court says, well, you know, the district court found the facts and we don't see any reason to overturn their decision. And since they found no safety benefit under this test, the state doesn't win. Some of the differences among the justices have to do with how much deference the state gets under the test. We know it's a contested issue because there's no uniform view of this. I mean, some of the members of the court think that the state should get lots of deference under the balancing test. Others think that a balancing test means the parties come before the court, neither of them have a presumption in their favor, that the scale is kind of empty. I do think there is a presumption in favor of the state in general, and the way we know it exists is what would happen if the plaintiff filed a case and showed some burdens on interstate commerce, a sufficient amount so that the case is not dismissed. I mean, you've got to show some substantial burden on interstate commerce. I mean, if all you have to show is, it costs us 5 cents a year, the case gets dismissed and the state never has to prove anything because the plaintiff has failed to prove that there's any substantial burden on interstate commerce. But assuming they show a burden and the state comes in and says, well, we have this is a safety advantage, and the plaintiff does not refute that evidence, does not show safety disadvantage. So we have the plaintiff's evidence of burden and the state coming in and asserting safety benefits based on, let's say, very flimsy and not very convincing evidence. But the plaintiff does not refute the safety evidence. Who wins?
The state.
That's right. The state's going to win. The benefit the state gets of the presumption of validity is if the plaintiff does not contest the safety evidence, then it's probably going to be enough for the state to win. But what normally happens, of course, is the plaintiff, in each of these cases, the plaintiff is not the plaintiff has deep pockets, right? This is a major national trucking company or whoever we're talking about in these cases. So they have deep pockets and they have expensive lawyers who are spending a lot of money, and they don't just listen to the state safety evidence and say, okay, well, that's nice, now court decide. Instead, they have tons of experts, more than the state has, and they introduce tons of evidence to show there's no safety advantage. And so when that happens, then the state loses. But the presumption would help if the plaintiff simply didn't introduce only introduced burden evidence, but didn't introduce safety benefits, an absence of safety benefit. But that just doesn't happen given who the parties are in these cases. And so we don't really see that case. We see heavily litigated cases where, if anything, the plaintiff has more resources than the state does.
They don't have to prove that there's no safety, just that it's slight. Is that right?
Well, the state, who has to prove?
The plaintiff or the challenger.
The challenger has to show that they have to show that the safety benefit is only slight or problematical. But while you're busy proving that, you're probably proving that it has you're trying to prove it has a safety disadvantage, because that's your, the chances of it being neutral, no benefit, no disadvantage, pretty slim. I mean, you have a safety innovation of some kind, or you have changed the rule, and it doesn't actually change anything. It doesn't make it safer or less safer. That doesn't happen very often. I mean, almost all the time it's going to do one or the other. I mean, it's a change, it must do something. The chances of it being just, an equal poise, the same exact you know, situation as before the new rule, or relatively slim. But obviously from the challenger's point of view, you want to show it's hurting things. It's making it less, the roads less safe. Because that's, of course, you know, the winning position where, you know, where it's a sure thing. Yeah.
Like one example that I can think of where, I don't know if this has ever been come up, but I've heard that like some states have really restricted gun laws on what kind of guns can be sold. So the guns that are sold in other states can't be sold in certain states. Such. And so that could be, you know, it's for safety purposes, but it would have an effect on the traffic of guns.
Of course, those cases nowadays are going to come up under the Second Amendment. I mean, so we're not really going to worry very much about the Commerce Clause. That's an area where we're going to mostly see a phenomenon that we are going to get to in a little bit, and it's kind of worth talking about here. Suppose and I'm going to just use the example of mud guards. Suppose Illinois won, and they convinced the court that the contour mud guards had a safety advantage. And 45 other states went to Congress and said, to their members of Congress, and said, oh, this is terrible. You know, this is going to be so expensive for our industry that Illinois gets to make this change. We don't think the court was right. What could Congress do if the state wins one of these cases?
Couldn't they make national legislation about what?
That's exactly right. They could make national legislation. They could simply take over and say that in the interstate trucking industry, from now on, trucks have to have straight mud guards, and states are not free to adopt their own mud guard standards. And in fact, over the years, as a result of a bunch of cases where this kind of thing gets litigated, the federal government has taken over the Interstate Commerce Commission, has made more and more uniform national standards for how trucks have to be outfitted. So one of the things that's true in this kind of area where we're talking about interstate commerce is Congress is always out there able to craft a national standard and oust the states from regulating in the area, even if the court says that the state law doesn't violate the Dormant Commerce Clause. That's not the limits of Congress's regulatory power. Congress can come in and simply create a uniform national standard, as they have in many areas, although not in all. And some of the time when Congress crafts those standards, sometimes they leave some room for the states to continue to regulate in some respects. So they'll list a bunch of things that the states can't do anymore where there's a uniform standard, and then they'll list a couple of things where the states can still do some things. And I mentioned this possibility because, of course, it's it is true in the truck cases, that in the aftermath of some of these early truck cases, Congress simply stepped in. But I also mentioned because in the gun context, there's a lot of federal regulations, and many of those federal regulations preempt what the states can do, and in some other respects, they specifically allow the states to regulate in some specific areas. And so we don't really have an absence of federal law. Remember, these Dormant Commerce Clause cases are cases where there's an absence of federal law, right? Congress hasn't acted, and the states are arguing that they can do various things, and the court uses the various standards that it does. But there are many areas where Congress has acted and has made clear what they want, what they are taking over, and what they want to continue to leave to the states. And so some state gun laws, for instance, are permissible because Congress has specifically allowed the states to regulate in certain areas over the years, And others are impermissible because Congress has taken over certain aspects of the regulation of guns. Now all of that is much more complicated because of the reemergence of the Second Amendment, and so we don't know which of those federal statutes are constitutional, and we don't know which of those state statutes are constitutional. But the reason why you haven't seen any gun cases involving the Dormant Commerce Clause has a lot to do with the fact that Congress has played a fairly active role and spelled out what the states can do and what they can't do, so you don't have this vacuum. This is a vacuum problem, these Dormant Commerce Clause cases, where Congress has not acted. And because Congress can always step in and act, that's why some of the members of the court, Thomas, Rehnquist, and others, have argued that if the law doesn't, Scalia, if the law doesn't discriminate or isn't guilty of economic protectionism, it's not a strict test case, that the court should not intervene and the law should be constitutional. They shouldn't apply the balancing test. If it's a non-discrimination, non-protectionism case, then leave it to Congress to intervene if they want to. That it shouldn't really be the court's job to play this legislative role of weighing the policy the benefits of some safety policy over the expense of implementing that policy. But that's not really a proper function for the judiciary. And so it's why a number of justices and a number of commentators over the years have simply thought that the court shouldn't be doing these cases, and there haven't been that many of them, and less in recent years as the Congress has kind of taken over more areas, so there's less vacuum than there used to be. But it's because Congress can always come in that there's been criticism of this line of cases, not the strict test cases, but the balancing cases, and this is of course added to by Scalia's, for instance, dislike of balancing tests because it gives the courts too much discretion. It's not predictable enough what the outcome is going to be. Okay, we can say goodbye to the balance for the moment. And in this little slide about the categories, I actually also included when the various tests are used, sort of just describing what we've been talking about, when each of the tests gets to be applied. Since we're kind of coming to the end of this area, let's do a few hypotheticals. Some of them we've done before, just by way of review. Two private colleges in the state of Soane. One has a student body composed of 90% Soane residents, the other 90% out of state. Can Soane give a property tax exemption to the first college and not the second?
I would say no. They could offer maybe a subsidy to that college or something like that, but not.
That's right. This is essentially the main camp case, just substituting the colleges for camps. And the answer is they can't do it because they're discriminating against out-of-state commerce in the form of students coming in from other states. Okay. City of Springdale passes an ordinance that requires non-recyclable solid waste generated within the city to be disposed of at a transfer station located within the city, and there are 5 private transfer stations within the city limits. Can the city do this? got waste, you live in Springfield, you've got to take it to a local transfer station.
No, this is a private transfer station. I think this is like the milk case.
It's like the milk case, it's like a home process, a local processing. That's right, it's a home processing requirement. And in that sense, it's like Carbone, the first of the transfer station cases where the benefit went to a private transfer station. Okay, the third one, the city passes an ordinance that requires all solid waste generated within the city to be disposed of at the Route 21 transfer station, a private facility within the city. And the Route 21, the owner of the transfer station has agreed to sell the station to the city at a low price in 3 years in exchange for the city's creation of this monopoly. Can they do that? It's private now, it's going to be owned by the government in 3 years.
Even though there was a case like that where it was not allowed, I would argue that.
Yes, there was a case exactly like this, which was struck down as unconstitutional. So what would you argue?
Oh, well, first of all, does it have a discriminatory effect? Yes.
We don't need a discriminatory effect. It discriminates on its face, right? It is discriminatory.
So then the question becomes whether there's a legitimate local interest that cannot be achieved by other means. I think the legitimate local interest, which is
what?
To finance this.
Right. Well, that was all true with the Carbone case. Every single thing you've said was true there, and the court struck it down as unconstitutional.
But in a later case, they upheld a situation where the transfer station was actually directly owned already.
Right. But this is not directly owned. And this is what happened in Carbone. Remember, they could buy it for $1 in 5 years. So this is 3 years. There's no constitutional distinction. This one they can't do. What you're now? Let's have you answer number four. City builds a transfer station. They pass an ordinance that requires all the solid waste generated within the city to be disposed of at the city's municipal transfer station. Can they do that?
Well, I know they can.
Yes, they can, because we read the United Haulers case, and that's what this is. The court says that favoritism in favor of a municipal facility performing a traditional governmental function is not the kind of behavior that the Dormant Commerce Clause was designed to worry about, so they would only apply the balancing test and not the strict test, and presumably the facts here are going to be the same in terms of being able to finance the municipal facility, and it's going to be upheld just as it was in United Haulers.
So for Hypo 3 and the Carbone case, I was thinking, I think Joe was getting at was like there's in the dissent, they were like, oh, come on, this is a government facility after all.
But there weren't enough of them. So the law is the way it is. And, if this weren't a bar exam, this is the answer, because that's the precedent. If it's an exam and you're asked to argue both sides, you can try and argue for one side that the court should abandon its view that this is private, it's really governmental, but it's an uphill battle because that argument just lost in a fairly recent case, and the court hasn't had that many changes in membership since that decision. Okay, the city builds a shoe store. After it opens, the city passes an ordinance requiring all shoe purchases within the city to be made at the city's municipal shoe store. Can they do that?
Probably not, because we've decided that a shoe store is not a traditional government entity.
Right. It's not trash hauling what else is a traditional governmental function? Well, we saw the bond case issuing bonds,
roads and highways.
Some sort of water treatment facility, prisons, traditional governmental function, operating prisons. I mean, there are lots of things the government traditionally does. And there are going to be close cases where we're going to start arguing about, is this a traditional governmental function or not? But shoe stores are never going to be on that side of the line.
Okay, so I'm a little confused as far as that and how it fits with the market participants.
We're going to get to some here. Remember, this is the city requiring people to buy shoes. They're not giving anybody they're not discriminating against, well, I guess they are discriminating against out-of-state commerce, but they're regulating by requiring people to buy their shoes, right? They are participating in the shoe market, but this is a regulation by requiring people to purchase their shoes. But the next one has the city operating a shoe store, selling shoes at 10% less than private shoe stores charge for the same shoes, and only selling to residents of the city. Now what are they gonna say?
It is constitutional because of the market participant exception, right?
The city is participating in the shoe selling market, and they are allowed to get the benefit of the market participant exception when they participate in the market. This isn't a natural resource, it's not a monopoly. I mean, there's no reason. It's not international commerce. None of the Alaska timber case factors where the court worried about the test, the exception swallowing the rule, are in play. And so the city is allowed to give the benefits of cheaper shoes, subsidized shoe sales to their own residents. That is what the market participant exception does. And remember, the market participant exception, they don't have to be performing a traditional function. Indeed, in most of those cases, they are not performing a traditional function. They're suddenly going into private enterprise, and in the first of the cases, building a cement plant and selling cement or whatever it is they've decided to do. So this is constitutional because they get the benefit of the market participant exception. Okay, number seven, the city builds a shoe store, sells 10% less than private shoe stores charge for the same shoes, but it sells shoes on the condition of that the shoes need to be repaired at any time in the future. The purchaser agrees to have them repaired at a shoe repair shop within the city of Springdale. And they do that.
Yeah.
Why can't they do that?
I forget what case it was. Wasn't it like the Alaskan timber case?
Absolutely.
Like they could be in the timber business, but the timber processing business is a different business.
That's right. They are regulating downstream activity. So here they're in the shoe selling business. They're not in the shoe repair business. So they cannot require that if you buy the shoes from them that you repair them within the city. That the market participant exception does not allow them to impose this kind of after sale restriction. And this is really exactly the facts of the Alaska timber case. I've just substituted shoes for timber. Okay, number eight. The state has discovered a large quantity of a rare mineral called glassets on land owned by the state. It doesn't exist in other states, although there's some in South America. It's very valuable because it can be added to the glass-making process to produce unbreakable glass items that look identical to ordinary glass. And the state has decided to set up the State of Stone Glassets Mining Company, a state-run company, to extract and sell glassets. And there's heavy demand for this product, and the state has decided it will only sell glassets to stone residents and businesses with manufacturing facilities in stone. Can they do that?
So, yes, because as a market participant, they can start a company and then they can sell to whoever they want. They can have a contract with whoever they want.
Okay, and what's the argument they can't do it?
that it's having an effect on activity that is.
It's a simpler answer than that. What did the South Central timber case, the Alaska timber case, say are some of the reasons why a state can't get the benefit of the market participant exception?
Monopoly and whether it's a natural resource.
Natural resource. This is the classic natural resource that's only available in one state, and the state has a monopoly on it, and so it violates the notion of the states sinking or swimming together. The economic unit is the nation to monopolize for their own residents this rare natural resource, and so I think that they would lose in this case because the court does impose that limit on the exception.
Is this like the Hawaii case?
But in the Hawaii case, the state wasn't in the business of selling wine, so we didn't have a market participant. I mean, we did have something that was indigenous to Hawaii and nowhere else, but the state wasn't in the business of manufacturing, distilling liquor from that wine and then selling it. And so we don't have this. We have similar facts, but on one front, but not the market participant exception. But I don't think the state could do this if the court means what it says in the Alaska case. State operates the state university. The total cost of educating a student each year, $25,000. They charge Stone residents $10,000 a year. Out-of-state residents are charged $20,000 per year for tuition. An out-of-state resident who attends the university wishes to challenge the constitutionality of the higher tuition charge to non-residents, claiming it violates the Dormant Commerce Clause. Does it? Does it violate the Dormant Commerce Clause to charge $20,000 to out-of-state residents and $10,000 to in-state residents if the cost of education is actually $25,000?
No, because the in-state people have been paying taxes, so they should get the benefit of the taxes.
Right, so the other $15,000 is coming out of the state's treasury. This is just offsetting, it doesn't even equalize, it still gives them a $5,000 break. But they can prove that these are actual expenses that the state is bearing and that their residents are paying for, and so this would be okay. I think we gave an example the next example is also one from class. Same thing, except now they're charging $30,000 for tuition for out-of-state residents. What happens now?
Now it does violate.
Because it exceeds their actual costs, and therefore they can't show they're just equalizing in-state and out-of-state. They're not just taking care of the so-called free rider problem, they're actually charging more of out-of-state residents than it actually costs them in combination between tuition and tax revenues. The state has set a minimum price for milk purchased by a Stone milk dealer from a Stone milk producer in order to assist Stone dairy farms, which are experiencing hard economic times. The state has also passed a law. So if you're a Stone milk dealer and you want to buy milk from a dairy farm, there's a minimum price you have to pay. This is called in-state transactions. The state has also passed a law that makes it illegal for a milk dealer to sell milk to a Stone milk retailer if that milk was purchased for less than the minimum price set for in-state purchases. So the Stone milk dealer goes out of state and finds cheaper milk elsewhere and now wants to sell it in Stone, and they can't because it can only be sold if they paid the minimum price for it. Can they do that?
I don't think so. I feel like are more similar to the garbage case, but I know it's supposed to be like the bean milk in that.
Well, it's not really like bean milk.
So it
but
is more like the garbage. I'm just getting confused by that.
Well, don't worry about what it's like, but what's happened here?
Well, because there's...
What have they taken away from out-of-state milk sellers?
The ability to be part of the market for the state, for the stolen state residents or buyers.
Because would you go out of state to buy milk if you had to pay the same amount as you pay in-state?
No.
Not if it, I mean, if you have to travel farther, the transaction costs are higher, and you have to pay, you can't sell unless you pay the same amount. There's no, you have taken away the, in some ways it's like the Washington apple case, you've taken away the price advantage of the out-of-state product.
Is it sort of similar like Philadelphia and New Jersey too with the garbage? But, or in that case that was just you had to use that facility, right?
Well, you couldn't use that facility. I mean, in that sense, it's a, it's this one is not an import ban completely, because you can import it if you pay enough for it, right? But you can't import if you've bought it cheaper. But this would necessarily have the effect of discouraging or taking away the price advantage from the out-of-state product, just in the way that in Hunt, it took away the quality advantage from the out-of-state product, and the state is not permitted to do that. I mean, the problem with this, of course, is it's hard to regulate. This regulation in the state is not going to be very successful if you can simply go outside the state and buy it cheaper. So that's why the state would want to do this. But the problem is that they are now discriminating against interstate commerce. The state recently adopted new safe milk safety standards. They're stricter than anywhere else in the country. They're designed to assure the safety of the milk supply. They're scientifically proven to make the milk supply 5% safer than anywhere else. The standards impose an expense on companies wanting to sell milk in stone to comply. It's going to cost them, as a group, $40 million a year to comply with these new standards. 25% of the milk sold in stone originates out of state. Therefore, $10 million of the financial burden will fall on out-of-state companies, and $30 million will fall on in-state companies. The new standards are challenged as a violation of the Dormant Commerce Clause by a major out-of-state milk supplier who sells 20% of its milk in the state of stone. So what case is this like? They did. They proved that it's a safety advantage. They proved it, even though it's going to cost a lot of money. Under the balancing test applies, because there's no discrimination. Out-of-state and in-state both bear the burden of this. It doesn't take away any advantage or give any advantage to in-state versus out-of-state. The state has proven a safety advantage, and presumably they should win.
But you would argue probably that the 5% right would be considered slight.
You try and argue, but 5% safety advantage is a pretty good safety advantage. You know, for it to suddenly be safer by 5% is significant. So I would say that companies are just going to have the choice of not selling in stone if they don't want to spend the money, or spend the money and sell in stone. I mean, that's, you know, going to be the choice that they're going to have to make. If other states start to adopt the same standard, then suddenly the economics of it change, and a major out-of-state milk dealer that sells in a bunch of states, and now a bunch of them are thinking of adopting these standards, is going to, is now going to have it look a little more reasonable to incur this burden. Of course, it's going to mean from a consumer that the price of milk is going to go up. Congress can always intervene and nationalize the problem and either adopt these standards uniformly or prevent their adoption, either way. Okay. Those are our Dormant Commerce Clause hypotheticals. All right, so that's the end of the Commerce Clause. I know, sad as it is. We're now going to take a look at a little provision in the Constitution called the Privileges and Immunities Clause of Article 4, which states, we have it on the bottom of 225, the citizens of each state shall be entitled to all the privileges and immunities of citizens in the several states. This provision in the Constitution is similar to the Dormant Commerce Clause, but not identical. It is, just like the Dormant Commerce Clause doctrine, designed to effectuate the notion of the nation as a single economic unit. States can't discriminate in various ways against out-of-state commerce. And so the same policies underlying the two provisions, but they are not identical. One significant difference is the Privileges and Immunities Clause is considered to be an individual right. So this is a right that attaches to individuals, just like equal protection or First Amendment, whereas the Dormant Commerce Clause is not really an individual right. It's a structural restraint. It has to do with the power balance between the states and the federal government. So it's a structural arrangement involving federalism limits. This is considered to be a right belonging to individuals that they cannot be discriminated against by other states in terms of their opportunity to engage in certain kinds of activities within those states. The most recent example of this, and the one that comes closest to home for all of you, is we have a couple of cases, but the last of them is Supreme Court of New Hampshire versus Piper. The Supreme Court decided in 1985. Until 1985, you had to be a resident of a state to be able to become a member of the bar of that state. What this meant was that when you graduated from law school, you could only take one bar exam, because you could only be a member of you could only be a resident of a single state at a single time. So residency was the requirement, and you had to prove that you were a resident in order to be eligible to become a member of the bar of that state. Now, obviously you could be the member of two bars by moving. You weren't permanently a resident, but you needed to be a resident, and so that had a significant restrictive effect on law students at the end of their legal education, and lawyers who actually had to move to another state and not just decide, oh, I'm going to keep living in New York, but I think I'd like to also represent clients in Connecticut, so I will take the Connecticut bar while I'm living in New York. That wasn't possible. If you wanted to practice law across state lines, you needed local counsel in the other state to take over the parts of the representation that had to do with practicing law in that second state. You couldn't just wander back and forth unless you had at one time been a resident of both states. Because one of the oddities of this rule was, if I graduate from law school and I'm a resident of Massachusetts and I take the Massachusetts bar, and the day after I pass the bar, I move to Connecticut, I establish residence, and I take the Connecticut bar, forevermore, as long as I pay my dues, I can be a resident, a member of the Massachusetts bar. It only required residency at the time that you took the bar exam and were admitted to the bar.
So you could just go wandering around.
Well, you could move a lot. Yes, you could. Today, as a result of the Piper case and the privilege and the court's interpretation of the Privileges and Immunities Clause, it is possible to do this without ever moving. If you think that studying for different bar exams is fun, you could do one a summer, for 50 years. Okay. So I've posted a bunch of material about this clause.
And I just briefly going to describe it, including a chart comparing the Dormant Commerce Clause and the Privileges and Immunities Clause. I've posted a summary of the various hurdles that you have to overcome to successfully bring a claim under the clause, and the test that the court ultimately uses if you survive all of those preliminary hurdles. This is the language of the Articles of Confederation, the original Privileges and Immunities Clause, and it tells you something about how the court interprets the clause the way it does because of its origins in the Articles of Confederation. And I added to the assignment just this fairly short case about game hunting in Montana, which will help you to understand how the court interprets the kinds of rights that are protected by the Privileges and Immunities Clause. And so we're going to start with that material next time. We'll go through the two cases that the book gives us, and then some additional hypotheticals just to kind of see how it all works. And then we'll go on to the next assignment. We'll begin with the issue of preemption, which we've kind of been talking about, which is when the federal government decides that they want to get involved and permanently regulate and oust the states